From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine World War II veteran shocked by the annexation of Crimea. We'll talk with Russia expert Strobe Talbot about tensions over Crimea. We'll also look at the human rights concerns in the CAR, plus fences and wildlife don't mix. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Crowds of pro-Russian demonstrators stormed government buildings on Sunday in several major cities across eastern Ukraine, where secessionist sentiment has sparked frequent protests since Ukraine's Russia-friendly president was ousted in February. In Luhansk, near the Russian border, hundreds of people surrounded the local headquarters of the security service and clashed with police there. Eastern Ukraine was the heartland of support for former President Viktor Yanukovych, who fled to Russia in February after months of protest. This Russian-speaking woman referred to NATO's embrace of the interim Ukrainian government. She asked who would prefer NATO over going home to Russia to be with family. About half of eastern Ukraine's residents are ethnic Russians, many of whom believe Ukraine's acting authorities are Ukrainian nationalists and will oppress Russians. Ukraine's interim authorities deny they are infringing the rights of the ethnic Russian population and accuse Moscow of trying to sow incivility. Meantime, Russia has moved large contingents of troops to areas near the Ukrainian border. Speculation is strong that unrest in eastern Ukraine could be used as a pretext for a Russian incursion. Veterans of World War II in Ukraine have expressed some shock at Russia's military aggression and seizure of Crimea. The former Soviet allies in October will jointly celebrate 70 years since the end of the war. But some veterans are now reluctant to take part. VOA's Daniel Scherf reports from Kiev.
World War II veterans of Kiev's Holosievsky district never imagined Ukraine would be a target of Russian aggression. Veterans organization council head Sergei Korokov says they are still stunned at their former Soviet allies' annexation of Crimea. And under Moscow's continued military threats, their plans to join Russia in marking the end of the so-called war against fascism are being questioned.
That is why all veterans are now worrying how we are going to celebrate and get ready for this date. Because on the border of our dear and beloved Ukraine are brothers, Russian soldiers. There are tanks, armored vehicles, and in my consciousness, in my mind, I cannot imagine how this could have happened.
World War II Navy veteran Dmitry Prohorov fought with the Soviets to defend Crimea, losing his arm in battle. He says Russia's taking back the Black Sea Peninsula by force is absurd.
This question should have been negotiated at a roundtable and decided for both countries, Russia and Ukraine. Both should own Crimea and work together to develop the territory in the Black Sea Navy. This would have been smarter.
Like many of Ukraine's veterans, Korokov has a Russian wife and says the two countries' destinies are interlaced.
I love our nation and do not want a feud. Even more, I do not want war. War should not happen between our countries. Let our politicians find an agreement, and we will support them.
Infantry veteran Georgi Kireyev fought in the Battle of Stalingrad, where more than a million died. He was shot 8 times and twice mistakenly pronounced dead.
Russia, Belarus, Ukraine are Slavic nations. It's one nation. They should live in friendship and happiness. I hope that with time this will happen. Maybe, taking into consideration our age, maybe we will not be alive at that time. Maybe our grandchildren will unite again with Russia.
Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
The annexation of Crimea under the order of Russian President Vladimir Putin has prompted much international response. Western powers have condemned the action and either imposed sanctions or threatened to impose sanctions for Russia's actions in the region. VOA's Kay Maddox spoke with Strobe Talbot, president of the Brookings Institution, and a longtime expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties including Russia. She asked him if prior to the annexation, did he suspect President Putin would go through with it?
I was surprised that the situation collapsed in the way that it did, and thought that, incorrectly as it turned out, that Putin would at least initially threaten annexation, hold it as a kind of sort of Damocles over Ukraine's head. I was surprised at the alacrity with which he did it.
We had this so-called diplomatic statement after Putin called Obama. We had the Kerry Lavrov meeting. Where are we right now? Is this diplomacy effort real, or is it just a distraction?
Unclear. It could turn out to be a sham on the Russian side, a distraction, but it's also conceivable that it might produce some agreements that would calm down a situation that is extremely unpredictable and dangerous. One thing we've got to accept, though, is that Russia has created a new fact on the ground, and that is the annexation of Crimea. It is extremely hard for me to imagine that Vladimir Putin is going to roll back what he has done. And I doubt that a successor to Putin would do so either, although it might be a successor who would regret what Putin has done. So we're stuck with what I hope the international community will not recognize as a legitimate fact on the ground, but it is an objective fact on the ground. And that is that Kyiv is going to have no governing authority over Crimea. Moscow is going to have governing authority over Crimea. And to the extent that the rest of the world can say that may be a fact, but it is one that contravenes international law, will help on other fronts. With regard to other fronts, there is no question that the Russian strategy going forward is going to be to weaken the Ukrainian state as much as possible. And the challenge for the West is to make sure that Russia does not succeed in that and that Ukraine gets back on its feet.
There is this theory out here that he would go after Transnistria because of it's a Russian-speaking enclave. He would connect the two. Where do you stand on that in terms of gaming where he might go?
Here's the key point. What Putin did in Crimea, namely to expand the territory of the Russian state, is the first time there has been such territorial expansion since 1945. But what they've done in Crimea is to make an organic part of Russia, the Crimean Peninsula. And that is an extremely dangerous thing to do because it's, ethnic politics. This is ethnic geopolitics, where you change borders and you conquer land in order to bring people of either the same or similar ethnicity into a country that presumes to champion that ethnicity. That's what led to a decade of horror and bloodshed and mayhem and genocide in the Balkans when Yugoslavia broke up.
Strobe Talbot, president of the Brookings Institution and a longtime expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties including Russia, he spoke with my colleague Kay Maddox.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Over the weekend, Israel's chief negotiator in the peace talks with the Palestinians says the talks are in crisis but need to continue. Tzipi Livni's comments came just one day after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Obama administration is reevaluating its role in the Middle East peace process, following moves by Israel and the Palestinians that have caused the U.S.-brokered talks to collapse. Mr. Kerry said Friday there is a limit to the amount of time and effort the U.S. can invest if both sides are unwilling to take constructive steps for peace.
Regrettably, in the last few days, both sides have taken steps that are not helpful, and that's evident to everybody. So we are going to evaluate very carefully exactly where this is and where it might possibly be able to go.
Peace talks veered off course when Israel did not release a fourth group of Palestinian prisoners on time. Palestinian leadership responded by signing application letters to a number of international conventions, seen as a move to gain statehood. Palestinians had promised not to attempt to do this during the talks. Israel did respond by canceling the prisoner release altogether. For some perspective on this latest give and take between the Palestinians and the Israelis, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with Haith Alamari, Executive Director of the American Task Force on Palestine, and Natan Goodman, Washington Bureau Chief of the Jewish Daily Forward. She asked Alamari why he thinks Israel reneged on releasing the last of the four tranches of prisoners.
As Palestinians see it, this continues in a trend of Israeli behavior where you agree on something and then you renegotiate it, you get the price once and you want to get a second price for it. So from the Palestinians' perspective, this was seen as an Israeli attempt to scuttle the talks and to even humiliate the Palestinians. It was not only the refusal to release the prisoners, but also the announcement of 700 settlement units in a suburb of Jerusalem, in a settlement in Jerusalem. And so all of these things together showed the Palestinians that the Israelis were not serious about moving forward and forced Abbas in some ways to have to take countermeasures to maintain some semblance of credibility to his own population and to his own constituency.
Turning to you, Natan Goodman, how do you see this Israeli reluctance at releasing this last tranche of prisoners? Do you see it as some sort of a way to humiliate the Palestinians, as Haith has communicated? How do you see it?
I think the perception of the Israeli government was that this final wave of Palestinian prisoner release, which included also Israeli Arabs, Palestinians that are citizens of Israel, which is a touchier issue for Israel, this is something that came with a certain political price for President Benjamin Netanyahu. The right wing within his government opposed it. And there was this feeling that if you go ahead with this final release of prisoners, but there is no promise for the continuation of the negotiations once the time lapses next month, there was no sense in actually going forward with this bold move that would cost him politically without any promise for future negotiations or something coming out of this process. So the political calculation on the Israeli side was, well, it doesn't make any sense to make this gesture right now when it won't lead to any results on the ground.
Haith Alamari, just a quick response on that. Can you see the logic in the Israelis' reluctance on this point and the timing?
When the Israeli government agreed to the four tranches of release of prisoners, they knew already that this is going to happen a month before the end of the talks. The Palestinians have already paid the price for that by halting their approach to the United Nations. So from that perspective, the Palestinians should feel they shouldn't be paying the price for Israeli domestic political concerns. This is an Israeli obligation, and they were expected to meet it.
How do you see it, Natan, this type of explanation?
For sure, it makes sense. Just again, to explain the Israeli rationale of this, and of course, there was an agreement with the Americans and with the Palestinians when the process started to release prisoners in these four tranches. However, if you reach the end of the process and it doesn't seem to be leading to any agreement, and it doesn't seem to be even leading to any extension of the talks in order to reach some kind of an agreement in 6 months or a year from now, it just didn't make political sense for Israelis. And that would be their overwhelming argument for doing so.
Let's move on to how the Palestinians reacted by seeking recognition for over a dozen UN agencies. Haith Alamari, was this in fact a retaliation for this reluctance on the part of Israelis for releasing the prisoners? What's going on?
First of all, to be technical about it, the Palestinians very carefully calibrated their move, and they're actually not joining international agencies. They have signed international conventions which are not attached to agencies. And the reason they did this is because if they joined an agency, this would trigger an American law defunding the UN agencies. And the Palestinians were very careful not to do it because they did not want to go on a head-on collision with the United States. Now, the reason they did it, partly to raise the temperature, partly to show the Israelis that there is a price to be done, it's a shot across the bow, as it were, but also for domestic political reasons, because Abbas felt at that moment he's already under attack from Hamas, from members within his own Fatah party, and he wanted to show that he is not someone who would just lie down and take the blows, but he has something to dish back. So it's a bit of diplomacy and brinksmanship, and frankly quite risky brinksmanship, but also a big dose of domestic political management.
So Nathan Gutman, with regard to this attempt, as Raif Al-Omari said, to sign on to not actually join these international agencies, which the Palestinians agreed not to do, but which they did, presumably in retaliation for the Israeli lack of releasing prisoners. How do the Israelis see this? Do they understand that it's probably more of a tactic rather than anything lasting? How is it perceived?
I think on a certain level, Israeli leadership understands that this is part of a tactic on both sides in trying to position themselves for the next round, and there are consequences for actions. But on the grassroots level, Israelis have this real concern about what Israel terms as lawfare, as going to international bodies in order to counter the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And these treaties, even though they have probably nothing to do directly with the statehood, are seen as another step towards this unilateral attempt to achieve legal status for the Palestinian Authority. And that is something Israel is concerned from. The concern in Israel shifted in a certain way from the military side, from the fear of another intifada, into the fear of Palestinians taking their own steps with international backing and gaining recognition as a state without negotiating it with Israel.
Nakan Gutman is Washington Bureau Chief of the Jewish Daily Forward. He and Haith Al-Omari, Executive Director of the American Task Force on Palestine, spoke with Carol Castiel on the VOA program Encounter. You can have more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look for Encounter under the Programs tab.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
An investigation by UN Human Rights Monitors have found that on March 29th, Chadian soldiers fired on civilians in the Central African Republic's capital, killing and wounding dozens of them. UN Human Rights spokesperson Rupert Colville said several sources have told the investigating team the Chadian force had entered CAR's capital, Bangui, to extract remaining Chadians and other Muslim inhabitants. He said the soldiers apparently were trying to save these people from attacks by Christian anti-Balaka militia.
As soon as a convoy of the Chadian National Army reached the PK-12 market area around 3 p.m., it allegedly opened fire on the population without any provocation. As people fled in all directions in panic, the soldiers continued to fire indiscriminately. At the time of the shooting, the market was full of people, including many young girls and women buying and selling produce.
Colville told VOA the Chadian soldiers were not part of MISCA, the African Union-led peacekeeping force in Central African Republic. He said they were part of Chad's regular national army.
There have been Chadian soldiers earlier as well as now operating inside CAR. In many cases, they've saved lives. They've evacuated both the people of Chadian nationality and also other Muslims out to Chad. And I think we should note that in many cases, they will have saved lives by doing that.
UN Human Rights spokesperson Rupert Colville. If you want to protect endangered species in the wild, don't fence them in. An article in the journal Science says fencing can actually harm both animals and ecosystems. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
Scientists at the Zoological Society of London and the Wildlife Conservation Society say the use of fences to protect threatened species should be a last resort. Researcher Sarah Durant.
Fences by their nature will segregate habitats, and that can actually be a real problem, particularly in dryland systems where wildlife often has to move quite large distances to access resources and water. So So that in itself can be a problem. And then you have wide-ranging species such as cheetah and wild dog, but also elephants as well, which need access to very large connected habitat for their survival.
Fences are not very widespread right now in Africa. Durant says the biggest concentration is in South Africa.
They're often used basically for territory protection. So people will own private land and they build fences around their private land to protect wildlife as a resource within those areas.
However, she says, there's concern more fences may be built as human populations spread further into wildlife habitats.
Governments, for example, very often see fencing as a potential solution to addressing human-wildlife conflicts. It's seen as a solution that appears more straightforward than it is in practice. Once you put a fence up, then you have to maintain it. And if you don't maintain it, you can end up with a situation where wildlife conflict could actually be higher than it was before.
Often, Durant says, local communities will actually breach such fences.
Very marginalized communities that have problems meeting their own household needs in terms of food and nutrition, very often they will want to breach the fences to gain access to the wildlife. And also fence wire can be used to build snares, and that can actually exacerbate a snaring problem.
She says many communities have developed strategies over the years to deal with marauding animals, such as elephants. Coping skills they might lose if fences are built around their communities, and then the fences are breached by one or more elephants. What's more, fences can build resentment in communities against conservation efforts. Besides that, the wildlife researcher says fences can affect predator-prey dynamics.
When you look at some of the densities of lions in fenced reserves, what you find is that they're actually kept at levels much higher than what the areas would be expected to support. So that suggests that it's actually altering the predator-prey dynamics. And lions aren't the only predators in ecosystems. You've also got other predators such as spotted hyenas, wild dogs.
Predators such as cheetahs and wild dogs need a lot of space.
They need areas in excess of 10,000 square kilometers if you're going to support what we call viable and sustainable populations of these species. They need very wide areas of connected habitat. Elephants and wildebeest can need areas in excess of tens of thousands square kilometers, particularly where you've got migratory systems such as you have in the Serengeti, where the wildebeest will range across areas in excess of 20,000 square kilometers.
Durant says one well-known fencing disaster occurred in the Kalahari. The fence was a veterinary cordon barrier. It was designed to separate wildebeests from cattle and prevent disease from being transmitted to cattle herds. What happened, she says, was the collapse of the wildebeest migrations in that region. She says instead of spending a lot of money to build and maintain fences, invest that money in alternative approaches. These include improved animal husbandry, community-based crop protection, insurance programs, and sensitive use of land to help prevent human-wildlife conflict. The authors of the article do say fences can be valuable resources in some cases. They cite the protection of birds in New Zealand against foreign species and safeguarding wolves and lynx in Scotland. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Former U.S. President George W. Bush has a new title to add to his resume, painter. The subjects of his paintings are world leaders, a theme he knows well. Mr. Bush's portraits went on display in his presidential library and museum in Dallas, Texas over the weekend. The exhibit is titled The Art of Leadership, A President's Personal Diplomacy, featuring paintings of world figures that he worked with during his years as president from 2001 to 2009. Among them are Russian President Vladimir Putin, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. Mr. Bush began his painting as a hobby 2 years ago. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Nashwan Kali, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On April 7th, 451, Attila the Hun sacked the town of Metz, a city now located in France, as well as other cities in ancient Gaul. The Huns were a nomadic people who dominated parts of Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia in the 4th and 5th century. In 1767, one of a series of conflicts between Siam and Burma ended following a brutal Burmese siege of the Siamese capital. The Burmese gains were lost a few years later when China invaded the area. A new Siamese dynasty emerged when the nation was restored in 1770 under a dynasty connected to the current Thai monarch. Hard feelings still exist between the modern nations of Burma and Thailand stemming from the conflict. In 1927, the first long-distance public television broadcast took place. A photo of Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover was broadcast from Washington, D.C. to New York City. In 1953, IBM unveiled the first commercially available scientific computer. In all, 19 units were manufactured, most of them for U.S. national laboratories, the U.S. Weather Bureau, and aircraft manufacturers. In 1954, President Dwight D. Eisenhower first spoke of what he called the falling domino theory, a concept that became the justification behind U.S. involvement in Vietnam. His metaphor suggested that if Indonesia fell to communism, all of Southeast Asia and Australia would be threatened. On this day in 2003, U.S. troops captured Baghdad in the Second Persian Gulf War. Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's regime fell 2 days later. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 28th, the World Health Organization, or WHO, certified its Southeast Asia region as free of polio. This is a remarkable achievement, given that less than 5 years ago, India accounted for more than half the number of polio cases worldwide. When no new cases of the polio virus appear within a region for a period of 3 years, the disease is considered to be eradicated in the region. WHO certification of Southeast Asia means that as of March 27th, 80% of the global population lives in a polio-free area. Polio is a highly infectious disease that can cause total paralysis in a matter of hours. It can strike at any age, but affects mainly children under the age of 3. The Global Polio Eradication Initiative is one of the largest public health campaigns in history. Since 1988, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the WHO, UNICEF, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Rotary International, together with scores of donor countries and foundations, have been working to eradicate polio by immunizing every child under 5. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, also played a critical role. USAID contributed to the success of the program by identifying the importance of transient populations, coordinating cross-border efforts and communication, recognizing the need for more women vaccinators. USAID also supplied a steady flow of funding. But the greatest accolades must go to India, a country that made a concentrated effort to drive out the disease and succeeded in doing so, despite the enormous obstacles that hindered its vaccination campaign. Some 30 years ago, India launched a massive $2 billion effort involving a surveillance and vaccination network of nearly 2.3 million vaccinators, religious and local leaders and mobilizers, film and sports stars. The campaign was a spectacular success. Polio can be stopped when there is political will, quality immunization campaigns, and when we harness the determination and will of nations, said USAID Assistant Administrator for Global Health, Dr. Ariel Pablos Mendez. The United States congratulates the people, political leaders, and public servants of Bangladesh, Bhutan, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, India, Indonesia, Maldives, Myanmar, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Timor-Leste on this singular achievement.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.